Hello and welcome to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears with the ace assistance of oldfootballshirts.com. Well, the new season is finally underway and last Saturday all the shock results were all elsewhere and Man City returned home with all 3 points. Today, we travel to Leicester, who lost in the 7-goal thriller at Arsenal last Friday. But our record at the venue formerly known as the Crisp Bowl is not too shabby, and maybe we could get our first point on the board. Also this week, the club have announced new deals for Lewis Dunk, Shane Duffy and Anthony Knockhart, and the work permit for Jose Izquierdo has been granted and subject to international clearance. He could make his debut against Barnet in the League Cup on Tuesday. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wears, and we're delighted to welcome back a man who needs to brighten up a little bit. Nick Schrapanik.
See what you did there.
I know it's really cunning. You haven't got a book coming out or anything, have you? Nick?
I'll find out.
Okay. I mean, if it's not a change of manager, if it's not crocking left backs, your now latest wheeze is right. Come on, every time there's a book coming out.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, between changes of managers and croc left back used to be so regular that I had to... But they're not anymore, so I had to find some other excuse for coming on here. So writing books, I guess, is the one.
Well,
yes. Anyway, crocking our left backs.
Yeah, welcome back.
Well, you haven't crocked one this year. Presumably you were at the game on Saturday. So
I was, yes.
Were you there professionally?
Professionally, yeah. And of course, and I've been at the training ground and in press conferences professionally quite a lot in the build-up to it because there was a lot of build-up. Let's be frank.
Okay, and that's funny. Funny you should mention that. There was an awful lot of build-up, and we were featured pretty prominently, and there was a lot of romantic stuff. There was a lot of stuff that forgot some history, and there was a lot of stuff that. Brought the history back into the public eye, particularly to a worldwide audience. So what did you make of all of that, and particularly what did your colleagues make of all of that as well?
Some of my colleagues in what used to be known as Fleet Street know the history and, you know, and had written extensively about it while it was happening. Others, some of the younger generation possibly had to be informed about it. But the thing is, you know, with many readers, you have to treat them as people who have completely blank pages and know nothing, so you have to some extent reinvent the wheel and go back and retell the story that we all know, of course, but might be fresh for some people who for whom football began in 1992. And so, you know, there's been a lot of sort of going back to first principle. Some of the Tony Bloom interviews were talking about, you know, his very early days as a supporter, and they're stories that we know, but, you know, I was doing a piece for two well-known broadsheets and I had to tell the story from the but his memories of the Goldstone and Peter Ward and Mark Lawrenson were good anyway, and of course for Albion fans they're a reminder of his true identity as a Brighton fan, not just somebody who wandered along with a load of money later in the day and built the stadium.
Well, look, there's also the whole point of, you know, telling the story to people who didn't know, but there's also, I think, and this is what the thing we did back in April, is also making sure that the story is kept alive as a parable almost for future generation of Brighton fans, those who weren't there. I mean, I'm thinking of Matt Francis, 19 years old, came on stage, told his story about not obviously the troubled times.
This is, of course, the Build a Bonfire
this
show. Build,
yeah, the Build a Bonfire on the 26th of April this year.
As mentioned in a rather good book, that's out.
Yeah, we're coming to this is going to be one huge plug, isn't it?
Oh, have we got a show on the 6th of September at the Comedia?
Who knew? Where was it? Yes, who would come on, who stated to the audience that he wasn't born, but, you know, the legacy for him is that we've saved the club, and it's not just saving the club, it's actually given him an opportunity to play power chair football, and not just for Brighton but for England and also the future generations. We have our stadium. I mean, we've got the Guardian sort of did an excellent video of somehow sort of getting 20 years story into 10 minutes, but through the eyes of the likes of Paul Samra and Liz Costa and John Bain, actually pointing out that, hey, we did this. And I don't mean just the Farmer for All people. I mean everyone who went on a march, who wrote letters, who campaigned, who sent flowers. So I think this is important that, you know, not just the story is kept, is introduced to new people, but kept alive for our generations.
Premier League Productions, to their credit, came up with a decent effort as well. You know, they got some footage from a Blackpool game at the Goldstone. And I think the history has been put before people, and I think people understand, you know, how long it took us to get where we are, and why it's possibly more of an achievement for us to have got there than some other clubs.
Although you've got Simon Jordan saying, you know, anything can happen when you've got someone who's going to spend that kind of money. Simon Jordan, of all people.
Yeah, it didn't happen for him.
Yes, but he's orange. He doesn't count. Mm. But, I mean, looking at the coverage we have seen this week, I mean, some of it has been particularly good, but there has been a glaring, great big Dick Knight-shaped hole in a lot of this.
The mind boggles.
Well, there was in the Premier League production thing, but I suppose it was who was available on the day, and Dick might have been on a holiday. Who can tell? I don't actually know the details of that. But it's hard, isn't it? Because I think Dick was on holiday and couldn't come to Ed Bassford's funeral, so maybe that was when it was done. That would be a fair enough reason. But I mean, Dick was pictured in some scenes, but I think him not being mentioned was a bit of an oversight there.
Whereas, sort of conversely, back to the Guardian one, Tony Bloom wasn't mentioned at all. Admittedly, that was just talking about the 2 years trying to get rid of Archer, the whole thing getting back to Brighton, and the subsequent years campaigning for the stadium and it being built. It's not as though, I mean, if you read that and took that particular video at face value, you wouldn't know who Tony Bloom was, let alone what he did. So, yes, I mean, I can't help feeling with each and every one. It's not as though, I don't think anyone's got particularly an agenda, but no one's told the whole story.
Well, I possibly, you know, to be putting a positive spin on it, there are so many people who have been involved in getting the club to where it is today that I guess, you know, getting them all in one production might be a big ask.
Yeah, that's a big wide-angled lens camera you're going to need.
Although, looking at it another way, I've been doing some work this week for a show that's coming up at the Comedia on the 6th of September.
More about that.
But as part of that, I've been re-watching things like With Dean Years and various other DVDs from that particular era. And you look at some of this stuff and you see the faces in the background of people like Paul Welsh and Ed and stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's just looking a little bit sort of more baby-faced than...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But, I mean, it's, you know, looking back at those With Dean years, we have to remember those. And I remember them very, very, very fondly. It's the most successful period in our history, let's face it.
If you're going to look at it in terms of silverware, absolutely. But, you know, I was speaking to a prominent FFA member, you know, Found Form Committee member, on Tuesday when the Albion had their open day, and you know their whole thing is to be fairly humble about it. I mean, you know, it's not as though they want to make a fuss, and I don't think it's necessarily even the club ought to honour them. I know that there's a move afoot for the fans to honour them, and I'm not actually sort of, you know, letting out any secrets here, but I think some of them, their attitude is, well, if you really want to actually sort of commemorate our work, look around you. This is our monument. This is what we did. I think it kind of slightly misses the point, but you don't want to go out of your way to embarrass them or offend them with that sort of thing. But you know, there is something that I think that us fans, us foot soldiers, would like to pay tribute to. But you know, that's something for another day, I think.
Absolutely. Okay, well, there was quite a lot of foot soldiers. Soldiers. I know, at the Amex. In fact, it was a record crowd on Saturday for the visit of Manchester City. For our first game in the top flight for 34 years, the Albion looked like this. There was a debut for Matty Ryan. There was Bruno. Another debut for Suttner. Lewis Dunk, Shane Duffy, Dale Stevens, Davy Prupper made his debut, as did Izzy
Prupper.
Brown.
Prupper. Is that how you've been told it's pronounced?
Yeah, how do you pronounce it?
I would have said proper, but if Werner says it's Prupper, I'm happy that it's Prupper.
It's got an umlauty thing on the O, so...
Okay.
So it's Prupper. I believe. And then there was Solly March, Thomas Hemed, and Pascal Gross also making his debut. Were you surprised by that team and the amount of debutants in it for such a big game?
I thought he might be cautious and put Sidwell on from the start and have Prupper on the bench just watching and ready to come on. But... I was a little bit surprised by Hemed starting. Perhaps the plan was for Hemed to run around and tire the City centre-backs out. Didn't really happen.
Not as such, no.
But trouble is, I think the early injury to Izzy Brown possibly upset the plans, because they had to make a substitution earlier than they'd wanted to.
I mean, I think Sidwell would have definitely got on the pitch if it wasn't for that.
Mm. It's possible. You know, it depends on how the game was going. I mean, if City had stuck sort of three or four past us, then maybe... you know, then you plug a gap a little bit, assuming that Prupper was the leak. But for the fact, well, if we're going to have a critique and we're going to zero in on one player, Brupa, off the ball, as were probably all the team off the ball, were actually very good. I thought we defended brilliantly, and this is a Manchester City team which is effectively Guardiola's, for me, is trying to make them into a Barcelona team and impossible get the ball off them. But they were, the Albion was so disciplined in defence. That said, when we did get the ball, I think that the first plan was give it back to them, because they hadn't actually seemed to have trained for having the ball with them.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of that.
Stage fright.
I'm not going to give Prepper.
Are we going to giggle about this all day?
Probably. But Davey.
Are we going to say his name properly?
Yeah. Davey. Like you said, off the ball he was fine. On the ball,
he was like a Preston Park Sunday footballer.
It was debut's first game at this level. I would have definitely played Sidwell ahead of him in this game.
But this is the problem if you bring players in late, you know, when the season started or just before the season starts, because they don't have a chance to bed in pre-season games. The whole point of pre-season games is to get the team up and running again and bed new players in. And you know, while I accept that there may be more bargains later on in the transfer window, this is the risk you run. It took Duffy a couple of games to bed in. You know, when we signed him, you know, late in the summer transfer window last season. But that's possibly the market we're aiming at, you know, price wise. So I guess we have to accept that.
But if you're looking at it in that sense, you think, well, Man City is a game where we're potentially, it's not a banana skin, it's a kind of an entire tree falling on you, and you've got this issue that, well, if we lose 9-0, it's because it's Manchester City, and you're not going to blame the players individually necessarily. So if someone's going to look bad, they're all going to look bad. But, you know, like I say, off the ball, you know, the I thought by and large, especially as the game wore on, ironically, even though when they scored, I thought we were actually looking more and more composed at the back. And until City scored, they were looking more, not desperate, that's not the right word, but they certainly weren't, you know, probably doing what they thought they were going to be able to do.
I've seen Manchester City annihilate more experienced Premier League teams than us. So, I mean, bearing in mind, you know, what people expected to happen to us and what I half expected to happen, I think it was a very good performance and a decent result. A defeat's never a decent result, but an acceptable level of defeat.
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, City had the ball. They had a lot of the ball. They had 78% of it, in fact. But they didn't actually do an awful lot with it. And it was actually individual errors that actually caused the problems.
They only had four shots on target. I mean, I don't recall them peppering the goal. I mean, they had the odd chance.
With Matt Ryan in goal, I would be peppering it.
Well, that said, he made a couple of outstanding saves. I mean, it's kind of Stockdale. There is an element of Stockdale Mark II where, you know, when a screamer's coming his way or heading for the top corner or it's a point blank thing, you're comfortable that he's going to do the business. It's when one comes trundling his way, you know there's going to be a touch of the Gary Sprague about it. Nick, do you want to fill in that particular detail?
Well, Gary Sprague?
Yeah.
Very accident prone Leeds United and Wales goalkeeper of the 60s and 70s. Dived over one in the 1970 FA Cup final. Let one through his hands in a game at Crystal Palace. Threw one in his own net.
Literally threw it into
at
his
Anfield
net.
In front of the cop. Yeah, his mistakes were legion.
That's not to say that we've got that in Matthew Ryan, but
Well, Sprague was taller than Matthew Ryan.
Yes, well,
he doesn't strike you as tall. Well, he isn't, is he? Let's be honest.
I think my daughter's taller than Matty.
I think he just needs bulking up a little bit as well. I mean, he does look as though if he had an ear piercing, it'll crash him to the ground.
He looks like a child wearing their dad's jumper, is what he looks like.
Yeah, he could do with a smaller goalie. I mean, who are we to sort of talk about this sartorial sort of jump? I mean, he's still probably, if we actually got to meet him, we'd probably realise he's still enormous compared to us.
Well, looking at that game on a sartorial sense, don't you just wish that we had Oscar Garcia on the bench on Saturday, because I mean he would have very nicely countered the Guardiola look.
I think there seem to be three looks in one there. I have no idea what it is. Was it grey V-neck, wasn't it, or grey polo neck?
It was a black jumper, white polo neck, chinos.
Oh, yeah, cream chinos and white trainers, white plimsolls, and we're talking about the $1.99. Woolworths ones here, aren't we? Well, they looked it from up in the West End upper.
Someone's going to tell me they're
probably a couple of grand each foot. As a look, well, it's attracted attention, but like I say, who are we to go on about it? I mean, if you're going to then compare it with the suave elegance of Chris Hughton, then yes, it is chalk and cheese. But above and beyond that, I think we'll leave it.
His fine performance in the press room afterwards, and that was another record crowd. Actually, the media room.
This is the new media room
backstage. Well, it's the old media room, but everything's been moved through 90 degrees so that everything faces in a different way. And there's a lovely glass wall, and I think they've got more people in that way. Mm. And it was certainly packed for Guardiola, and slightly less packed for Chris Hughton, but also the. What's known as the mix zone, which is it's allegedly supposed to be a place where journalists and players mix, but it's actually a place where players show off their new headphones wearing them as they walk past us. But even that was packed when there's normally two or three people hanging around afterwards. So, but the new facilities backstage held up very well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to the game then. Jamie Murphy came on for Izzy Brown after he got crocked with a hamstring, and he's now gone back to Chelsea to have his treatment. So he'll be hanging out with his mate John Terry. He's also just hanging around there having ice baths, apparently. But
I thought he was
Okay. Club captain at Aston Villa, but still going back to Chelsea for. Yeah.
So I understand we've lost him until at least after the international break. So
okay, well, that's not too long. But, I mean, it's an option
that's been taken away from us. Because, I mean, think with Izzy Brown. We saw him play against Madrid and, for the first few minutes against Man City. Yes, he's comfortable on the ball. He's confident on the ball. All right, he was up against a big team. But I kind of feeling that, his talent is wasted out there. Bearing in mind we've been screaming out, maybe either Hughton doesn't fancy him out there, or he doesn't fancy himself, or we're just assuming it's going to be the case. But when you see him out wide, you think, actually, you could do so much more damage in the middle.
Hughton has said he sees him as a number 10, so, but you can't play two number 10s, or can you?
Or can you? But then we think of the number of wide players that we've actually got, and we're going to put a number 10 out wide.
And we've got another wide player arriving next week.
Izquierdo, indeed.
Izquierdo, because he's Colombian.
Answers on a postcard, kids. you got told by Brian, didn't you?
Yes.
Was it Izquierdo?
You do pronounce the Z, yeah.
Yeah.
But
not Izquierdo.
No, that's Spanish.
That's Spanish, yeah.
Pass.
Yeah.
Pass.
Yeah. I was going to say, Spanish is the th, and the South American Spanish is z, or yeah. S. Yeah.
I've got a shirt of the week to go yet.
Joey left anyway.
Yeah. Okay, well, City did have the ball in the back of the net, and it was disallowed because it was the hand of Jesus.
Yeah.
Not the hand of God, it was the hand of Jesus.
I was about to say his dad from 30-odd years previously. and what did he do? Did he run into Matty Ryan or the post or the... I mean, because he stayed down for a while, so if he ran to Ryan, then and he came off second best.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not so shabby.
Good by Michael Oliver, one of the best referees in the Premier League. Didn't make any mistakes, I didn't think. I mean, sometimes when we've seen Premier League referees guesting when we were in the Championship, they have been less than impressive. Hmm. Roger East, not to mention, that person that we don't mention, but Oliver's good, I think.
Is that person we don't mention actually been to the Amex?
I believe not, no.
Okay.
I'm sure he will get a very warm reception when he does.
He might be like Kelvin Morton, one of those who somehow doesn't get timetable to appear there.
Well, Ron Chalice, I think he's actually going to join a long sort of, well, this stops there admittedly, but a long list of...
Shortlist, I think is what he called.
Of asterisks that are not going to be made welcome. But that's an interesting point, is that does any club have the right of veto of a given referee?
No, but I dare say Paul Barber might be having a word with the refereeing people and saying, there are one or two people who might be less than welcome and for their own sanity or,
safety.
But I think in that case, the person that we can't mention wouldn't be welcome anywhere.
I'll mention him. I swear. I'm going to swear. Mike Dean.
I'm going to edit that out.
But, I dare say he will be, and he won't.
It's going to be the Palace game, don't you?
Don't even go there.
Actually, I've just sworn again, haven't I? Yeah, no. Sorry.
But, let's move on. A patient build-up leads to Aguero crossing for Jesus, whose header was brilliantly saved by Ryan. That was like, as you mentioned there, the good side.
It was a good save, and it wasn't just the fact that he stopped it going in. He actually managed to push it aside. And you can't help thinking, I don't know what the fellow was like before, but that was a save straight out of Ben Roberts' textbook. You know, you've seen other goalkeepers do that. And whereas I can think of other goalkeepers we've had who push the ball straight back into play, ready for someone to tap in. So, no, that was a really good save.
I've also got Aguero is put through, but a dunk puts him off after a Duffy cock-up. And Aguero missed.
Are we talking about the one in the second half?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, oh, God, that was...
I mean, you've seen him a lot more than
close.
Us.
Wasn't even close.
There was a game, I think, at Manchester City last season, at Southampton last season, and City were so on top, it was ridiculous, but they just didn't score. And you thought, are they going to forget to score in this game? But I think they finally got a goal after an hour, and then they ended up winning 3 or 4 nil, but they could have been 7, could have been 8. So, you know, they're not necessarily the most clinical finishers. It's just they tend to make so many chances that sooner or later they will win 3-0.
But it was after that, and it was still 0-0, when we actually started to have a bit of a spell in the game and we actually started to press them. I've got a comment on Man City's shape, because it was they played with everyone behind the ball and very narrow, which made it very difficult for us to get any space in there. But we did break. Jamie Murphy broke, and no one went with him, unfortunately. I suspect if Knockhart was on the pitch, that would have been celebrating.
If yeah.
But he checked back and we got a corner out of it. And then
here we are celebrating a corner. I mean, this is the Albion rule. We're actually going, yes, we've got a corner.
Well, no, I mean, it was. The corner comes in, the pinball's around, and then Duffy's shot on the turn just goes wide.
This is the one where their keeper was flapping, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yet another unimpressive Manchester City goalkeeper, and you just wonder how bad is Joe Hart with his feet that Guardiola doesn't want him, but he wants these other guys who just can't do some of the other goalkeeping basics,
like save it. Or catch it.
Yeah.
No, that was some real sort of Premier League flapping, that was. And then I think, was it that one where the shot came in from the edge of the area, or was that a subsequent corner?
That shot was, Duffy's shot was deflected just wide, which was going in. And then that led to another corner, which saw a dunk blocked twice before Prepa, rifled wide.
Yeah, and I think if Dunk had stuck his leg out a little bit more, he might have actually managed to guide that in. He wasn't that far away from it. I mean, that to my mind was about as good as it got for us as an attacking intent. And yet we've been talking, one of the things that we do as part of the Albion Roar is that we do go onto other people's shows, and we're a regular, semi-regular guest on the Anfield Wrap, which is, I've never heard it because I understand it's behind a paywall, but their attitude was along the lines of they were surprised about how much the Albion gave it a go. And I'm thinking, we didn't even have the ball. So I think they were expecting...
28% of the time we did.
I think what they were expecting is just this absolute, you know... Well, it was Man City with the possession, but I'd be surprised if the possession stats also pointed out that they spent all that time with the ball in the penalty area.
Well, it was. I mean, like I said, they had all this possession and, there was neat little triangles all over the place. But it's like watching us under Gus. There was a lot of passing, a lot of movement, but we didn't actually do an awful lot with the ball. And it wasn't actually until... De Bruyne picked the pocket of Dale Stevens, who divvied a little bit, that they broke and scored.
Yeah, that was kind of a salutary lesson as to welcome to the Premier League.
Yeah, I was on Radio Sussex talking about, you know, how the Premier League would be different, and I said one of the things, what you must not do is give the ball away. Certainly don't give the ball away in your own half, because, you know, once you've done that, then they will be on you. As most predators would, it can get very ugly very quickly. It threatened to when the second one went in, but I think after that, I think City thought they'd possibly done enough, which is a relief, perhaps.
Well, it was a little bit. I mean, I felt that they did actually take their foot off the neck a bit, but it was... I mean, I think what we've seen is a sample of what Man City can do. And I think that there will be times when they are going to absolutely slaughter people. But I can't help feeling, maybe it's, if you can't take it all from one game, but I can't help feeling it's actually a lot of times going to be quite boring watching City this season. I'll tell you why. They're going to retain the ball a lot, but they're also, I mean, probably Brighton's given the rest of the division a certain heads up, in as much as you can stifle them. If you're disciplined in defence, you can stifle them and you can frustrate them, but you just have to accept that unless you're anywhere near as good as them, you're not going to get the ball. And therefore, it's going to be a bit like... I mean, it's when Spain won the European Championship and the World Cup. I mean, they won every game 1-0 because they passed it sometimes for the sake of passing, and there was elements of that. I mean, you can tell.
Found Spain unwatchable at times.
Oh, there was tedious at times. You know, the skill and the amazing ability was there, and yet it was just completely undone by pass. And you think, well,
I remember once they actually passed through the lines and they got their false nine within sight of the penalty area, and he turned around and then passed back into the midfield.
Mm.
And I just thought, well, what was the point of all that then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a quick word on the ball from David Silva for Aguero. Beautiful.
What, for the goal?
Yeah.
Well, it's just one of those things. The pocket is picked. Three quick passes later, it's in the back of the net.
Mm.
Team can't get back quickly enough. And, you know, like I say, welcome to the Premier League.
Okay. Well, City did make it 2, and it was an own goal from Lewis Dunk. How many own goals has he got now? He must be getting on for Virgo's record, is he?
Occupational hazard of being a central defender and having to stick your head in front of a football travelling at pace.
Yes.
So if he just got slightly on the wrong side of his man, and I don't know whether he thought he was just nodding it back to Ryan to start another attack, but Ryan seemed pretty shocked by it.
Ryan's starting position for when the ball came in was dreadful.
Where do you think he should have been?
I think, well, he should have been at the near post. The guy at the...
Well, he wasn't near post. I'm thinking
no,
that wasn't the problem.
He was off his line, and there was a massive, great big space between him and the post. And when the ball did come in, he was out of position, and we just basically threw it in his own net.
Well, the fact that actually he managed to get anything on the header coming back to him, there was nothing that header could have gone anywhere. I mean, close to him, went through this loop in his arm.
Where it did go, it should have been a yard further back, and he would have saved it, but...
For the back.
I thought he was on his line.
He wasn't.
No,
right.
He wasn't.
Because he actually fell over the line as well,
no,
didn't he?
No, he wasn't on the line. Mm. No.
From the press box, rather unfortunately, is not the best place to see these things from.
So do you think you'll ever get a chance to watch it? Because there's a new press box up at the very top of the West Upper.
Yeah.
And that was where previously it was just sort of a few empty seats where maybe one or two stewards who didn't fancy doing their job might sit. They've got it all sort of properly...
I think wasn't it used for the Rugby World Cup, I believe? And I think it was also used for one of the Arsenal Cup ties as a press overspill. It's where the main press box is, or the equivalent to where the main press box is at Hull City's ground. So... It is a view, and it makes it look more like a chess game in that you can see, the tactics and the moves and the formations more clearly. But you don't see the blood, sweat, and tears quite so.
I was about to say. So where as a press journalist, a football journalist, when you're watching the game and you're being asked to report on it, where is your optimum viewing platform?
Where Tony Bloom sits.
Same as everyone else who wants a best seat.
View, I think, in the Premier League, bizarrely, I think, at the moment, is Watford. Because the new Elton John stand is quite steep, doesn't go back very far, so you're quite high up and quite close to the action. So I think that's probably the best view, so, you know, halfway line. But
And will you be there next week?
Don't know yet.
So when you're down in the regular sort of like the initial press area, which is like I say just above the dugouts. Mm. I mean, do you feel that you're missing out on sort of something?
Yeah, I mean, when I did the hard hat tour with Martin Perry, I said, "Where's the press box going to be?" And when he showed it to me, I said, "Well, I think it's a bit far forward." I was actually thinking about getting rained on. And he was saying, "Oh no, only the first 10 rows." We'll get rained on. I said, yeah, assuming there's no wind blowing in. And I think one of the ramp-up games, we got rained on.
Mm. I believe the press box at Whitehall Lane was a lot closer.
Oh, awful, yeah. Yeah, close enough to hear Sam Allardyce swearing and
chewing.
Well, we don't have that problem anymore. So anyway, the game finished 2-0. We were on match of the day. There was a bit of editing, things like those magnificent balls through to knockout from Lewis Dunk were completely.
He was quarterback in again, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was beautiful. But I mean, a fully fit and functioning knockout would have brought those down and.
Yeah, if
we'd have been eating goal pie, but it was. But I mean, you've watched a lot more football than us at this level. What do you think we need?
Youth and pace.
I think you said that last time.
Yeah, well, it's still true. I suppose that, you know, when you think about it, the three guys who've been given the new contracts are all 25, so they're looking at, you know, their prime coming up. Izquierdo, similar sort of, you know, early 20s. He does look fast. He could be giving us... those things. I mean, Knockout is tricky. He's possibly not the fastest, but if we're bringing in, you know, one more forward, then you know, they've got to be younger than we've got and faster
and better.
Well, of course. You know, you assume that if we're going to be close to breaking the transfer record again or breaking what would have been the transfer record again, that we will be getting better. There's no point in getting not better, is there?
Well, quite. But then, having said that, I can't help feeling that the players that we got in, of all the players, like you say, the question you asked earlier, were you surprised? Suttner, Prupper, even Brown, I couldn't see... or Matthew Ryan had to get someone in. I couldn't see that they were markedly better than what we'd had before. And it is unfair to judge them on that first game. But it's not as though I saw a particular leap in class.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? You judging people on a performance against the title favourites, I think, you know, we should be judging them against West Brom in a few weeks or tomorrow or at Watford, I think. And then... It's a fairer platform on which to judge them. I mean, I think that there was an element of caution, a bit of an element of stage fright about last week. Now that's out of the way, and you know, you go to an away match when you're not under any obligation to entertain or to get anything. You're just there to annoy the home fans and you know, by stealing points from them. And I think that might be a better platform on which to judge these people.
I've got to say that, I mean, of all the team that started and played, I think only two really looked as though they were totally at home in the Premier League, and Bruno was one of them.
I mean, Solly March, the other
one. Solly March was the other one. Solly March, you think, well, is he going to make the step up? And well,
you forget Lewis Dunk as well.
Lewis Dunk,
I didn't think Duffy did well. I thought.
Well, I couldn't have seen that at times that with Dunk and Duffy, they, you know, certainly in the first half, they were a bit too eager and getting under each other's feet a little bit. And the mistakes that they were making could have been shown them up as sort of horrific.
Part of that was because the team shape and the tendency to give, well, the acceptance that City would have the ball pushed everybody back. And to some extent, everyone was being sort of on top of one another. I think that was part of a function of the way that our tactics were.
But yeah, I mean, it's just that Solly March looked great. Sadly, he did most of his trickery in the right back position and defended well, considering he's supposed to be a sort of an out and out sort of tricky winger. He spent most of his time looking after Bruno, but then, like I said, Bruno, I had no qualms about. He's played, you know, a squillion games in La Liga, looked comfortable, 37 in a couple of months' time, fit as a butcher's dog. No worries. I just hope that everyone else can make that sort of step up.
Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham. I'm here with Alan Wears and Nick Schrapanik, and we are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. And we have a shirt of the week, which I'm just going to pass over to the esteemed gentleman over here. And okay, if you could just describe this one for us, gentlemen.
Okay, can we get that colour first? I'm not sure, is from the nature of the print, whether it's blue or brown. And I'm not having a Phil Shelley moment here. Didn't he go to a game this week when it was green against red?
Could be maroon.
It is maroon.
Yeah. Brown is St. Pauli, so that's maroon.
Yeah, okay, so what we're looking at here is a maroon shirt with white trim down the side. We've got Bimbo written across. There's an awful lot of advertisements on this. There is an element of Formula One shirts about this. We've got Huawei on the front. We've got a big S in college writing here with three stars above the top.
Three stars, eh?
I mean, I couldn't tell you which. I'm going to guess it's an Hispanic side because there's a sponsor of Banco Popular.
And Bimbo is a South American bread.
Right, is this I'm going to guess this, I don't know the team, but would it be Izquierdo's original home club?
No, it's not.
Okay, go on then.
Okay, here you go then. This is your first Costa Rican league shirt of the week.
The week?
Yeah. Shirt of the week, Costa Rican, first Costa Rican shirt of the week.
Okay.
Yeah. And our good friend Marcus Hancock brought this back for Phil from his recent tour of Central America. And this is the 2017 Deportivo Saprissa home shirt. And they are known as the Purple Monsters.
So it is purple, not maroon. Whose printer did that come from?
Mine.
Well, it's either that or it's bad. It's a bad picture, Marcus.
It's the light in here.
I think so.
It's actually Phil.
Are we
Phil owns this thing now. It's actually...
I bet he does. Yeah. It's actually, I mean, it's I'm going to say it's a nice colour. I mean, I do like that kind of tone colour because actually it's mildly slimming. So I can understand why Phil wants it.
Anyway, so they are known as the Purple Monsters. Saprissa are one of Costa Rica's top sides and they won the 2016 Invierno tournament and were runners-up in the 2016 Verano tournament. Combined, this makes them the current champions. They have two different championships in South America.
Invierno is winter and Verano is spring.
Yeah. They play at the 23,112 capacity Estadio Ricardo Saprissa Ayama, also known as La Creda del Monstruo. This is in the San Juan district of the Tibas Canton. They have.
We knew that.
We knew that. Yeah. I'm just loving the way he's reading it as if he was in Inigo Calderon.
All the listeners know that.
Yes. They've won the league a mere 33 times since their inception in 1935 and have had 10 players turn out more than 400 times for them. Current Arsenal permanente Joel Campbell played for Saprissa in 2009 before joining the Gunners. He's played 23 times for Arsenal and 100. Loaned various other people. The bizarrely named Yeltsin Tejeda, named after Russia's first ever president, played for the S, as they also known, between 2011 and 2015.
Yes, yeah, with three gold stars. Yeah.
Costa Ricans often refer to their significant others as their media naranja, which means
other oranges,
the other half of their orange. Yeah. When women give birth in Costa Rica, they say "ella diarus," meaning she gave a light. I've got no idea why you put that in there.
Give people to the light.
Yeah.
Yeah, Phil, he's either been eating Wikipedia or he's just gone off in this bizarre flights of fancy. He's gone off in this bizarre fugue. The other thing about Costa Rica, I think it was them, wasn't it? They were the only side in the World Cup. I think they conceded the fewest goals in the World Cup in 2014.
They failed to beat England. That made them particularly...
Yes, that is quite embarrassing for them, isn't it? Yeah, I think they got to the quarterfinals and only conceded two goals in the whole tournament. And then Germany turned Brazil over 7-1, so I think they dodged a bullet there. I think it was Costa Rica, wasn't it?
Costa Rica and Chile did particularly well in that World Cup.
Yes.
Was it São Paulo? São Paulo? The manager.
Don't know.
São Paulo.
Bald fella.
St. Paul, basically. Is that what you're saying?
I can't
remember.
Yeah. Anyway, we are delighted to have Nick Schrapanik with us again. And last time you were here, Nick, you were plugging a book called Pulp Fiction. And this time you're plugging another book.
Of his own.
Oh, Pulp Football, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I kept getting that wrong.
Did I?
So
you've got another book called Brighton Down.
Yes. No, that's
what have you been doing this summer, Nick?
Yeah, I've been writing a book.
Yeah, okay.
I started it after the Wigan game. It was obviously the sold to the publisher as the story of our glorious promotion, but obviously rather dependent on that happening, as nobody's going to want to buy a book about two successive failures to get promotion. So it's actually it's about the two seasons together. So it starts with Chris Hughton putting together the side that narrowly missed out and then went to glory. And it sort of, it takes in Shoreham and the consequences of that.
The air disaster.
Yeah. Paul Barber, spoke very movingly about that. And as did David Stockdale, who, of course, he was involved, working with the families. And I was, told about how the emergency services were sort of there at the training ground on a day-to-day basis. Essentially, I asked the club if they were planning to do an official book and wanted to throw it in my hat in the ring to write it for them, but they said they weren't, but they'd give me every assistance in writing one myself. So, I was given access to players, managers, Tony Bloom, Paul Barber, and, as much as I wanted, Chris Hughton's written a foreword. And anything wrong with the book's my fault.
And everything that's right with it?
Is the players. I mean, we know what happened, in the broad sense, but, possibly we don't know how Paul Winstanley and Chris Hughton went about putting the team together and some of the ways that, they look for players and some of the processes they go through. Talking to people like Colin Calderwood about what it's like working with Chris Hughton, talking to Ben Roberts about some of the penalty saves that Stockdale pulled off and the theory behind that. The club was a bit reticent about letting me give too many secrets away, so that no forwards will be able to read this and find a way to score penalties against us. Those particular secrets were redacted.
Yes.
And there was one or two things about player recruitment that have to remain secret, of course, so that other people don't copy the Albion's methods. But pretty much everything else.
Are we talking Smarties here, or are we talking,
you
have to build your own i360?
I'm sworn to secrecy. But,
are we talking about Tony Bloom's network?
Has he got one? Oh, you amaze me! That would be under wraps. I think it was mainly to do with the amount of research that the club does on players. But the two signings that Paul when Stanley went into most detail about were Shane Duffy and Anthony Knockhart. And without giving secrets away, it's pretty clear why we got them at bargain prices and others didn't, because. Oh, right. It's just simply to do with being more thorough, and going into, what players want, where they want to play, how they want to play, whether they're suitable for us, talking to their agents over a long term, and just seeing, just generally being smart.
What about the players that were there that necessarily didn't fit in? Like the Elvis Manu, for instance, was he given... Because he scored last season, don't forget.
He did actually score a goal,
twice.
Yes. But I think, you look at our success rate with players, and I think since Paul Winstanley took over from David Burke, I think there's been the hit rate has been pretty good. I think there was a whole tranche of players who came in late under Sammy Hupia that just didn't really work out. And I don't think that we necessarily signed players who fitted the style that the manager wanted to play. Well, that's very, very different now. I mean, Chris Hughton...
I don't think the manager knew what style he wanted to play.
I think he did. I think he wanted the fullbacks high up the pitch and providing the width. But the trouble is, if your fullbacks are in their 30s, that you're asking an awful lot of them to get up and back. And of course, actually having a left back of your own who isn't on loan, was a big plus. So Guy Ten Bong, despite my uncanny ability to get rid of our left backs or get them carried off on stretchers. we actually did have a couple. And I don't think we can really complain about Paul Winstanley's strike rate. I think it's been pretty good. So, I mean, for that reason, I think that I tend to sort of trust that the players we've signed probably are good. perhaps one that wasn't that successful was Chuba Akpom. He did. I think that was unfair. I think Izzy Brown is a better and more proven performer at our level. I mean, the thing about Akpom is he hadn't been particularly impressive for Hull, whereas Izzy Brown was impressive for Huddersfield. So
there are questions about his mentality as well.
Mm. Yeah, no, there were. I think the mentality issue, and getting people who fit in with the squad, and the togetherness is important. I mean, I was privileged, if that is the word, to be in the among the media guests on the players' bus during the Open Top bus tour, and I mentioned something about that in the book, but generally speaking, it's what happened on the bus tour stays on the bus tour, I have to say. But I can tell you that the team spirit is excellent.
Right.
There was a lot
Does
of...
Does it involve Shane Duffy and Google?
It involves Shane Duffy and Glenn Murray's sunglasses, but no, there was...
the mind boggles.
Oh, yeah. They'll have to boggle, I'm afraid. Once All again, right. you know, that was...
Okay. How was the book actually written? Is it written in diary form, or is it?
It's a sort of straightforward trot through. But I've tried to essentially. I wanted as far as possible the key moments to be told in the words of the players and the manager and things. And so, and the more detailed, I tried to find a moment in the 2 years. To go into more detail about a particular character, so the part where I talk in most detail about Chris Hughton was immediately after the game away to MK Dons, because there was a very memorable bit of YouTube video where when the penalty goes wide, it's absolute bedlam in the technical area and Calderwood's jumping around, the subs are jumping around, and Chris Hughton is absolutely immobile, just sort of staring into the distance. And, you know, if you want a picture of Chris Hughton, that's it. So that was, I thought, the point to put the Chris Hughton interview. And others, you know, I think Stockdale, I'll go into a lot of detail during the chapter about Shoreham, about him. Murray, at various points after his, you know, he came back and scored on his second home debut against Nottingham Forest. All those players.
Does he mention about sort of the whole thing of, or do you touch on the thing about sort of his move to Palace first time round?
Well, I think he said it a number of times, you know, he didn't necessarily want to leave. And then, you know, once you've got to leave, you then take the best offer. He's not a fan as such, although, you know, he has a soft spot for all his clubs. And he says that, you know, he enjoyed his first spell at Brighton, although some people seem to think he didn't. You know, and once he left us, although he kept living in Brighton, he just went and was a Palace player. But he didn't celebrate goals for Palace against us. He didn't celebrate his goals for Reading against us. So he observed the proprieties.
I'm still absolutely baffled by the fact that we let Murray go. Like, especially now when this week I've just seen that Craig McHale-Smith just signed for Wickham this week. And
why did Bournemouth sign Murray? A player is uniquely unqualified, you know, and unsuited to their playing style.
Well, we have touched on that in previous roars.
And Murray himself is, I think all he said about that says, I had that conversation with Bournemouth and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
So he obviously didn't understand it either.
Okay. Yeah, so was it a kind of a, I mean, obviously you're getting paid for it, but was there an element of labour of love through, you know, sort of, well, the deepest, darkest recesses of every single person's wardrobe?
I was persuaded to write Pulp Football. This one, I thought I'd have to persuade people to let me write it, but actually I found myself pushing an open door because I think people thought, well, a Brighton promotion book, if they get promoted, should sell itself. And then, as I say, my job was not to mess it up, so to let the players and staff's words speak for themselves and let them get on with it.
And, of course, you're following in the footsteps of the late, great John Vinicum's Up and Away.
You know, that was very much in my mind, you know, that that's a book that a certain generation of Albion fans have on their bookshelf, and I even included results and goal scorers in the same format as it is in Up and Away for any real anoraks out there. Of course, he got to write a sequel about them staying up, and that, of course, is the aim.
Well, the lovely thing about, I think, probably one of the...
Have you got a working title?
Well, I think it was just called Seagulls, the second one, wasn't it?
Super Seagulls?
Super Seagulls. Well, the lovely thing about that book, and it was unusual for its time, was actually the front cover picture. It was a rarity. It was a full... glory colour picture. I think we were playing Charlton or
I think it was a
Blackburn.
Home defeat by Bristol City, wasn't it? Oh, no, the Super Seagulls. Oh, no, it was a Charlton home game.
Charlton home game, and 30,000 plus in the... talking of 30,000 plus, that's something that you're talking about. You talk about this right at the very top of the show. Just quickly get back onto this, and we'll get back onto the next book in a minute. Did you know that the capacity at the Amex has been reduced this season to 30,666 to cater for all the improvements and things? Yes, I know. It's the plus 30,000, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, the 30,415 was only there for being able to carry the 251 seats short, probably most of which were the gap between the home and the away fans. So there's your little stat for you, the capacity. This is according to Kieran Maguire. So if that stat is wrong, then... Well,
Kieran's normally pretty good with stats.
Kieran is always literally on the money. So,
okay. So Nick, in regards to your book, I mean, we've mentioned the stuff with Paul Winstanley and stuff. I mean, that's pretty much the most. Is that the standout point for you in the story?
Not so much. I mean, I spoke to Chris and a lot of people about what it was like after the Sheffield Wednesday game. You know, how bad the atmosphere was in the dressing room, and to Tony Bloom and to Chris about, you know, how on earth did they pick people up after that. I also spoke to Alan Mullery, of course, who had a similar experience. You know, they had a narrow miss and Mullery picked the team up. I spoke to Brian Horton about that.
That's incredible to the parallels, really. There,
yeah,
isn't
it? It is.
And there were parallels in that Mallory said that, you know, he believed that in the players they'd come very close. It was just a question of same again. You know, we go again. You know, go on holiday, boys, and come back and start afresh. And that's what Chris Hughton did, really. And Tony Bloom and Paul Barber said, you know, they had a board meeting scheduled for the morning after the Sheffield Wednesday game. It went ahead. They put the Wednesday game to bed and started again. They gave Chris Hughton a new contract that day. Paul Barber has a photograph taken at that board meeting on the shelf next to his desk, in his office in the North Stand, as a sort of reminder of, onward and upward.
All right, because it's... Like I say, the parallels are frightening. I mean, obviously, you've got Newcastle involved into the mix as well with those parallels. But
both promotion seasons began with an away goals draw.
How many parallels have you worked out?
Well, there's one or two.
There's one. So
what are you doing about you know? Well, and if the parallels continue, then brilliant, because we lost to a very good team at home in the first game, and trouble is we're going to lose the next two as well if the parallels are followed. But then we're going to
I think our first win in the first division was against a fellow promoted. No, it wasn't. It was the previous promoted side.
Against Bolton.
It was against Bolton. So who was promoted immediately the year before us? That would have been Hull and Burnley and Middlesbrough. So that actually forget that. Right, that's not happening. So
let's beat West Brom anyway.
Let's beat
Watford.
Leicester would be nice as well. I can. It's a kind of a funny thing. Now we've got over this hump of only losing 2-0 to Manchester City. I fear that not so much the players will take their foot off the gas, but they will play not with a. I'd like to think they'll play with a sense of freedom, but more so with. a sense of discipline, because there will still be opposition teams who are capable of tearing them apart if they're not careful.
I just don't want them to be like Middlesbrough. I want them to give it a go.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to take
almost
this,
did and,
want
and
to
it
miss
came
this
off.
Opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, moving back on to books then, because we've been asking you this week, because in honour of Nick's appearance today, we've asked...
And Bob's last week, of course.
Of course, yeah. Oh, yeah, but he's got a book out as well. He's plugging that somewhere else, though, isn't he?
I couldn't tell you where. I forget. Do tell.
Oh, what? The Comedia on the 6th of September?
Okay, let's do this properly. Right, okay, Wednesday, 6th of September, at the Comedia. We've got an evening with Bob Booker and Mark McGee. We're going to be recording an Albion Royal radio show for later broadcast, probably 6 weeks hence or thereabouts. It's £10 to get in. There'll be, like I say, recording an hour, and then a few drinks. And basically, if you want to come along, get sozzled and heckle McGee and Booker in the second half, please do. It'll be a Q&A session. Will Freddie be there? Who knows? But yes, it's we know that Bob is a great raconteur, and if you can hear Mark McGee, he's a great raconteur too. Yeah, I'm going to ask if McGee does a really good impression of Booker, then see if we can set the record straight. Yeah, yours truly, as is the chap over there with the other microphone, will be hosting it. It'd be lovely to see you come along and support us, and come and hear Bob. And he's got a book to sell. And if you're really unlucky, if you're really lucky, you might find an unsigned copy.
Yep. So it will be a tale of getting up, staying up, and why you should be a bit worried if Dick Knight asks to take you out for an Italian.
Yes.
Indeed. But, okay, but we've been asking for your top five football books this week, and it seems that most of you seem to spend more time reading about it than watching it.
Have been some really good football books written. I mean, I can't help feeling that... When I was growing up and reading all these football books, there were these all fantasy books of some kid who made it great, always playing for Liverton against Everpool, or the whole
You're
thing.
You're talking about Brian Glanville's book, Goalkeepers Are Different.
Those kind of things.
Regarded as a classic.
Yeah, well, there's a whole load of them with the beautifully cartoon drawn, illustrated, really bad shirts, blue shirts with red and white diagonals and orange shorts. And
Sheffield United's kit of the 70s.
That kind of thing. Yeah. And I think it sort of all changed a little bit with Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch. Everything, I think everything else was up for grabs after that, because it was a different kind of writing. I can't have a feeling there was an element of Year Zero about
it. That's actually football fiction, isn't it? So, I mean...
No, it's autobiographical.
Yes.
I mean, it's semi-autobiographical, certainly.
Somebody said recently they broke up with their girlfriend because she described Fever Pitch as a novel.
And,
No. That's a bit extreme. But
yes, quite. No, it's semi-autobiographical. But I think it just sort of changed the way that football writing didn't need to be just about sort of fantasies. By all means, you could have the autobiographies, but there are other ways of actually telling football stories. And I think it sort of came up with a whole host of... Well, pretenders, frankly.
Well, let's just talk about a few that have been mentioned a lot. I mean, quite prominent, of course, are Gary Nelson's two books, which was Left Foot Forward and Left Foot in the Grave, which were two fantastic.
Well, the first one was shortlisted for the Sports Book of the Year, and yes, both excellent, really well told. I think the one that seems to sort of really hit most people, and it was slightly before Fever Pitch, but I think it was because it told a different story. Is Pete Davis's All Played Out?
This is the one about the
Italia 90 of how people were treated in those days.
But don't forget, if you go back to the Glory Game, Hunter Davis's fly on the wall year with Tottenham, including Alan Mullery and Joe Kinnear and Alan Gilzean and. Real, all access all areas stuff, warts and all. And apparently the Spurs chairman agreed to it because he thought it would be great publicity for the club. But it just led to great humiliation for the
I mean, that's one that Warren Hatter's mentioned here, as well as quite a few other people have mentioned this as well, which is the Miracle of Castel de Sangro, which is, I mean, I've not read that, but I mean, it's...
Is this one you're familiar with?
Yeah, yes... The trouble is, you see, I mean, I came up with a list of five, and then as soon as I'd put it on Twitter, I came up with another list of five that I'd forgotten, some of which were the thing about football books now is there's such a proliferation of styles, subjects, everything now, tactical books, you know, inverting the pyramid. Who'd have thought that there would have been a book like that come out written by a journalist rather than, you know, a coach?
It was kind of more the history of tactics, though, wasn't
it? You look at someone like Mike Calvin, who's, you know, somebody I know and somebody I admire very much as a writer. You know, he's written about scouts, he's written about youth policies, he's written about top quality managers. And there are so many subjects now that people are interested in and want to read about. Yeah. You know, they want to read about small Italian clubs. They want to read about South American football. I hope they want to read about the Albion getting promoted. I mean,
My Season in Verona by Tim Parks?
That one.
That's been mentioned.
Yeah. Impression is that Albion fans will buy this book and nobody else. But who can say, you know? I mean, there might be people who read When Saturday Comes who would be interested to, you know, to find out more about the Albion story. And
Even as much as when you're talking about Newcastle fans still have a soft spot for Chris Hughton. Mm. If they realise that the book is going to be, or major, quite a bit on Chris Hughton, and realise what's happened to him after, you know, how a football club is actually treating him good and appropriately.
Tottenham and Vancouver fans might want to know more about Paul Barber.
Well, quite.
Absolutely. And we're just reading Bob Booker's book at the moment, and it will be on sale at the
Premier League. I love that. I mean, I know Greville, who's written it, and I was very interested by the chapters about Sheffield United because, you know, that Sheffield United is a rather sort of offbeat and oddball sort of club, and it was... It's very interesting to hear Bob's experiences up there.
Yeah. Well, there's a touch of Inigo Calderon. He is their Calderon up there. I mean, he's sort of like the trier, wasn't there forever, but, you know, was always sort of the man.
There's that magic.
Fair enough.
Everyone always loves one of those. But unfortunately, that is all we've got time for this week. So, of course, thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you again to Nick Schrapanik. Where can we get the book?
From the publisher's website, which is Bite Back, from Amazon and from good bookshops near you if you live in Sussex.
And I can tell you now, actually, City Books have already got it in stock in Western Road, Hove.
And it's not even published yet.
There you go. Well, I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you again next week. Cheers. Bye.
Can't judge apple by looking at a tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at the mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book. by looking at the cover. I gotta say, you got your radio turned down too low. Turn it up. Ow. You can't judge sugar by looking at the cane. You can't judge a woman by looking at her man. You can't judge a sister by looking at her brother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. Well, I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Come on. Oh, how am I doing, baby? Looking in the pond, you can't judge right from looking at the wrong. You can't judge one by looking at the other. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't.